Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone. At betterhelp.com/public.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It is 7 o'clock. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org.
Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants.
Our temperatures right now range from 15 in Aiken to 23 in Brainerd. It's 18 in Grand Rapids, 19 in Hibbing, and 20 in Bemidji. For today, sunny. Highs 38 to 42. Light southeast winds, partly cloudy tonight. Low 17 to 25. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny. Highs in the low 40s.
Coming up will be local news with the Up North Report. 7:20 will give you some ideas of things to do in the community. It is events up north.
And at 7:45, what we're reading, Tammy Bobrowski talks to Minnesota author Will Weaver about his follow-up to Power and Light. It's called Black Dirt, Bright Stars.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Connecting with nature is part of the Anishinaabe way of life, and on the Red Lake Nation, a charter school is seeking to help foster that connection, incorporating Ojibwe language and tradition with the seasons. Red Lake's only charter school recently partnered with the Nature Conservancy for the purchase of a new pontoon to take environmental learning out of the classroom. The nonprofit's tribal relations coordinator, John Littlewolf, is at the Boy Fort Band with ties to the Cass Lake area. He says the goals of the Nature Conservancy align well with the priorities of the Red Lake Nation.
Peatlands, water quality, science and monitoring, these are our specialties at the Nature Conservancy. And so again, it is a natural fit with the Red Lake Nation on so many fronts. And this opportunity is such an exciting one for me because these students are going to be able to experience something that I wish I would have had this opportunity going to school to be able to get the classroom out onto the water.
During the inaugural pontoon outing on Fuller's Lake Wednesday, a handful of charter school families braved the cool November weather for boat rides and hot chocolate. Fuller's Lake is tiny compared to the nearby Lower Red Lake, but features interesting islands and beneath the water surface, some underwater caves. The charter school's executive director, Nate Taylor, says he was reminiscing about special memories.
So we grew up playing all through this area. Like I said, I was drowned in this lake where kids, we swam all the time here. And it just was, it's like one of those epiphany moments, like where you're just in the moment and you're really happy. And I started singing a song because I was remembering him.
Taylor says the song he was gently singing above the roar of the pontoon motor was one he wrote for his younger brother who died young from juvenile diabetes. Fuller's Lake is just a couple miles away from the charter school and will be one of the many water bodies within the Red Lake Nation the students will explore with their new equipment.
We wanted to know about, you know, almost every single tree that's out there, every single plant that's out there, every single, because we did know at one point, every fish that's out there. So this boat will give us the opportunity to get kids out on the water and, you know, get in to learn about, you know, Mother Nature from a perspective that you don't really get to if you don't have them.
Indaji Nitawaging is the name of the Ojibwe Language Intensive Charter School for grades K through 8. Kindergartners and first graders experience more Ojibwe immersion than older students, but the entire school's curriculum is closely tied with language and seasonal traditions.
There's types of seasons when we gather wild rice, type season we gather blueberries, strawberries, maple syrup, and just reconnecting. I think it's our moral responsibility to do that and to get our kids to do that because our people always thought seven generations down the line. Our ancestors thought of us And that's why I feel like Red Lake is so strong.
Taylor says the school, initially chartered 4 years ago, stemmed from a decade of dreams that began with a pre-K program called the Wasabic Ojibwe Immersion School.
This school kind of evolved from that because we were teaching kids the language at 3 and 4 years old, but you need to keep on them because at that school it was only 4 hours for 4 days.
Revitalizing language and education is key, Taylor says. The U.S. and Canada's prior policies of residential boarding school systems frequently took Indigenous students out of their communities where they were punished for speaking Indigenous languages or for practicing traditional customs, in addition to suffering other abuses.
My wife and I had some firsthand experience. We went to Haskell Indian Nations, and it's a college that's built on an old boarding school. So you can see like the evidence of what happened. You see child handcuffs and different things, a historical center there of, you know, of what happened. There was railroad tracks, and they would ship us in like cattle, and a little bit of the history of what happened to our people and why we don't speak our language.
Native American students continued to face several challenges within the traditional American education system after the boarding school era. And Aji Nitawaging's director of academics, Rochelle Johnson, says the school takes a more holistic approach to education.
We develop a strong sense of belonging, a strong sense of who they are as young Native people in the community. And we're really community-based. You know, and practice local culture with, you know, and teach that.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXC News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
It is 7:07. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Heidi Holton.
Coming up, we'll have more from Morning Edition. We'll also bring you ideas on what to do this week in Northern Minnesota. Lots of events always going on, and we want to hear from you. You can tell us what's happening in your community. Send us a write-up of an event to psa@kaxe.org. The Northern Community Radio Board of Directors meets at 6 o'clock Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments@kaxe.org or call 800-662-5799 during business hours. Regular meetings of the Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org.
We continue now with news from Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, some National Guard troops are told they may return home after duty in Chicago and Portland. We begin with active duty U.S. forces who continue their deployment off the South American coast.
The Trump administration is putting more pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Over the weekend, the U.S.'s most advanced aircraft carrier arrived in the Caribbean, joining nearly a dozen other naval warships that are already there.
The president has been weighing military options against Venezuela, and he told reporters last night that Maduro appears ready to talk.
We may be having some discussions with Maduro, and we'll see how that turns out. They would like to talk.
The U.S. has been blowing up small boats leaving Venezuela and other South American countries, claiming they are transporting drugs. The open question is what else the U.S. means to do.
For more, we go to NPR's Carrie Khan, who is in Bogota, Colombia. So, Carrie, what has Maduro said about the buildup off the coast of Venezuela?
Over the weekend, he gathered supporters and he announced this plan to rally civilians to defend Venezuela against attack. But listen to this. He told the crowd he just wants peace, peace, peace.
Peace, peace, peace. Hacer todo por la paz.
Everything for peace, he says, like the John Lennon song Imagine, which he then began to sing in English.
Imagining us people.
Yesterday, the U.S. said it will designate the Cartel de los Soles, which they claim Maduro leads, as a foreign terrorist organization. Maduro denies he's a trafficker.
Yeah, that designation would allow the U.S. military to target Maduro's assets in Venezuela. So what are people in Venezuela saying about any imminent U.S. strike?
Well, the thing is, I can't get into the country, eh? We've been asking for a visa for months, and I'm waiting here in neighboring Colombia with our latest ask. The country's opposition leader, though, Maria Corina Machado, she put out quite an interesting message yesterday urging Maduro's security apparatus to defy his orders.
Bajen las armas. No ataquen a su pueblo.
She says, lower your arms, don't attack your people. She says, the decisive hour in Venezuela's liberation is coming, and she urged people to be heroes. Machado's been living in hiding since last year's elections that were widely condemned, and many, including the USA, were stolen by Maduro. But there's a lot of talk now that she actually left the country and is on her way to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize next month. It's unclear if she will be allowed back in the country.
Now, you were just in Ecuador yesterday. That's neighboring Venezuela and Colombia, where voters there rejected a referendum that would have let the U.S. set up a military bases to fight against drug traffickers. Why the no vote?
It was really a bit of a surprise, given just the surge in drug gang-related violence there. It's just overtaken that country. And multiple Trump officials have been visiting Ecuador recently. They've been backing the young conservative president there, who is a staunch Trump ally. The measure included rewriting the Constitution. And for many, like this no voter, Rosita Guchimillo, a 48-year-old homemaker in Quito, this was really a no-confidence vote for President Daniel Noboa. She says, we just don't trust him anymore. She says he'll rewrite the Constitution to favor himself, and she didn't want to give the U.S. what she said would have been a blank check.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Bogota, Colombia. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, so what is the point of the U.S. military pressure? We've called a careful observer, Jeff Ramsey, who's at a think tank in Washington, the Atlantic Council. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Do you feel that you understand the president's ultimate goal when it comes to Venezuela?
Well, you know, I think it's a fair question. And I'm not sure that anybody really has a clear sense of exactly what the main objective is with regard to Venezuela. I mean, we've seen so many mixed signals with regard to this president's policy to the country. President Trump has lifted sanctions on Venezuela. He has negotiated a prisoner swap with Nicolas Maduro. He's deployed this massive naval deployment to the Caribbean. And then just yesterday, as you all noted, he is now talking once again about negotiations with the dictator.
I'm just curious, is that a small person in the background that I hear there?
That would be my cat.
Oh, that's your cat. Okay, well, greetings to the cat. If the cat wants to join the discussion further, the cat is always welcome. So I guess one stated goal is, of course, to cut back on drug trafficking, and the implied goal that people perceive is an effort to change regimes. If the president talks of negotiations with Maduro, which he has been talking, as we've heard, to achieve what? What would the point be there?
So I think, you know, this administration is going to be very focused on migration policy, on making sure that Venezuela takes back the hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants who have lost legal status thanks to this administration's decision to end temporary protected status for something like 700,000 Venezuelans in the country. I think the White House will likely be very interested in advancing energy interests. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves on the planet. But I certainly hope that any kind of deal with Maduro emphasizes the need for a peaceful, democratic transition. Maduro lost last year's election. Yet he stole it anyway. And Venezuelans are hungry for change, and I think they deserve a peaceful, democratic way forward.
Are you surprised that the Venezuelan opposition leader, although she's been very supportive of Trump on occasion, has also tried to keep just a little bit of distance, a little bit of caution here?
Yeah, you know, I think Maria Corina Machado has played her cards very well. On the one hand, obviously, the United States is her biggest potential ally against Maduro, and so she has to be very careful to toe the line and express gratitude for President Trump's support. But on the other hand, you know, she just won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, she in recent years has really been an advocate for a peaceful, democratic path forward. So I think she's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. And so far, she seems to be playing her cards well.
The United States has talked of designating a criminal organization in Venezuela as a terror group, Cartel de las Soles. What is the point of calling, and if I can ask that question yet again, what is the purpose of declaring this a terror group, and what leverage would that give the United States? What legal rights would it give the United States, if any?
So, you know, Cartel de los Soles is basically shorthand for military involvement in drug trafficking in Venezuela, which is a real problem, although the reality is that something like 75 to 80% of all illegal narcotics that make the way to the United States pass through the Pacific, not actually through the Caribbean and not through Venezuela. There has been some speculation that designating the Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization could justify military escalation, including airstrikes inside Venezuelan territory. But the president, or the secretary of state, actually has set a deadline for this designation. Secretary Rubio has said this wouldn't occur until November 24th, which is a week from now. And meanwhile, President Trump is talking about negotiations. So it seems like the scene is set for an ultimatum for Maduro. It looks like the U.S. is interested in negotiating, but they're setting a time limit on those talks in the next week. Otherwise, I think they're going to escalate.
When you say you're not exactly sure what the ultimate goal of the United States is it possible that we're correct in that? Because that has been the situation with a lot of negotiations with the president around the world. The negotiating partner is not exactly sure what the United States wants. They're just trying to get different things at different times.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there may be an element of strategic ambiguity here. You know, I think President Trump may have been refraining from laying out exactly what he wants to see, partly because he's, you know, hoping for a win above all, and maybe a little bit flexible on exactly what that looks like.
Jeff Ramsey is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, an expert on U.S. policy toward Venezuela and Colombia, and a cat owner. Mr. Ramsey, thanks very much to both of you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Of National Guard forces in Chicago and Portland. As NPR's Juliana Kim reports, the move comes as those deployments have been stalled for weeks by the courts.
A defense official who was not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that about 200 members of the California National Guard will be leaving Oregon, while 200 members of the Texas National Guard will be leaving Illinois, both in the coming days. That's not a surprise to retired General Randy Manner, who was previously a top official at the National Guard Bureau.
I believe, quite frankly, this administration is 100% pulling them back because of the nonstop resistance through the courts and of the local leadership in those communities who do not want them to be there.
The Trump administration initially deployed the Guard to Portland and Chicago to protect federal buildings and personnel, including ICE. Leaders from those cities sued, accusing the president of exceeding his authority. So far, the courts have sided with the states and blocked the deployments, meaning troops are unable to conduct any operations in the streets. The defense official told NPR that the holidays may have also played a role in the decision to withdraw out-of-state troops. General Manner says that's important.
I hope the reason is someone is actually thinking of the morale of those soldiers that are deployed doing literally nothing.
The military's Northern Command hinted on Friday about the changes, but emphasized that the Defense Department is prepared to deploy in the future, quote, as many troops as needed for as long as needed. The court battles over the deployments are also far from over. The Supreme Court is currently weighing whether to allow President Trump to mobilize troops in Chicago. Meanwhile, the Trump administration recently appealed the court order in Oregon that permanently blocked any deployment.
I'm going to be constantly watching if this is the calm before the storm.
Manner says he's worried about Trump escalating the use of the military, noting that the president has repeatedly expressed interest in doing so. About 300 Illinois National Guard personnel will remain in Chicago, and 100 from the Oregon National Guard will stay in Portland. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXC. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. I'm Jennifer Barr with Heidi Holton.
Coming up before 8 o'clock, we bring you what we're reading. It's our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. For those of you who are fans of Minnesota author Will Weaver, he's got a brand new book out, and Tammy's bringing us the story. It's called Black Dirt, Bright Stars. It's a follow-up to Power and Light. We're hoping for a whole series on this.
Yeah, the Haugen family. I really enjoyed Power and Light. Mm-hmm. So excited to see where they're going. Support for KAXE comes from the Third Coast Chamber Collective, presenting chamber music up north, featuring an internationally renowned accordion and violin ensemble from Poland at Co-House, November 20th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at thirdcoastchambercollective.com.
It's going to be sunny today, highs 38 to 42 with light southeast winds. Partly cloudy overnight tonight, lows 17 to 25, and mostly sunny for tomorrow. Tuesday, highs in the low 40s and overnight lows near 20. There's a lot going on right now, including KEXE being chosen for Newsmatch 2025. It's a national campaign supporting local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You helped us get here, and now your gift can go even further. We have over $35,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift will be matched 3-to-1, up to $1,000 while funds remain. Campaign runs to the end of the year. You can give now at kaxe.org. We are already in the 3.5 years or so, right, of the KAXE newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be 4 years coming up this in 2026. We have seen such impacts that following stories in our local community of our journalists headed out to local government meetings, what that means for people to be more informed. So this support means that you're going to know more about your local community, about the issues that face the people here that you're not going to find in any other media. It's a great way to support something you care about and to support your community. So do that now at kaxe.org or call us anytime to talk more about this news match that we've received.
It is time for Events Up North, a closer look at some of the events happening across northern Minnesota this week.
The Great Lakes Area Performing Arts are holding auditions for the Tin Woodman of Oz. It's tonight and tomorrow night from 6 to 9. Either night at Pequot Lakes High School Auditorium, there are roles for adults and youth ages 10 and up.
Itasca Housing Resource Team hosts Soup on the Street this Wednesday on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. There will donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served.
And the Laurentian Chamber of Commerce hosts a community bonfire. It's at Silver Lake in Virginia this Wednesday from 5 to 7 p.m. You can enjoy holiday music and make your own s'mores. Soup and chili will be served.
And Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night this Thursday. Doors will open at 6. Performances start at 7.
The Mountain Iron Buell Drama and Chair present Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, November 20th through the 23rd at Merritt Auditorium. You can find tickets and showtimes at chair-mn.org.
And Watermark Art Center has their final poetry slam of the year this Thursday at Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. Music starts at 7, poetry at 7. Music starts at 6, poetry at 7. Poets should prepare 3 original poems, each under 3 minutes. Contact Watermark Art Center to guarantee your spot.
Going on in Baxter, it's a holiday market at Northland Arboretum this Saturday from 9 until 3 o'clock.
And the City of Virginia has a Twilight Holiday Parade on Saturday starting at 5:15 on Chestnut Street and then going down Fifth Avenue. Fireworks will follow on the shore of Silver Lake.
And Bemidji Chorale is presenting The New Day. It's a celebration in song. Saturday, November 22nd at 7 p.m. and Sunday, November 23rd at 2 p.m. at Calvary Lutheran Church in Bemidji. Hey, Jennifer, you know these things better than I do. Is next week Thanksgiving?
A week from Thursday.
Okay.
So the 27th is, yeah, Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah, lots of holiday events coming down. I've been keeping a list. I haven't been putting them in our on-air events yet just because we've had a lot, but I'm going to be working on that today, there's some Thanksgiving meals in the area and then all those tree lightings and parades and things coming up.
So, yeah. Lots of things start opening up on Thanksgiving weekend, and we would love to hear from you about some of those holiday meals, because sometimes it's hard to know what's going on in small communities to help out folks at this time of year. So we would love to hear from you. You can email psa@kexe.org.
And Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. You can find this week's list of events at kexe.org.
Coming up later today, 8:45, we're going to be talking to the folks behind My Neighbor to Love Coalition in Brainerd. They are working to end homelessness for 30 neighbors this December. Construction nearly complete on 19 units at Creekside Community, but there are funds needed to purchase basic household furnishings. Learn more at mntlc.org/donate or just tune in at 8:45 this morning.
And then coming up at 9 o'clock, Chris Walker, your host for Headwaters. And it's Monday, so it means he'll do the request line at 10:30, taking your song suggestions. He wants to hear your awesomely bad song suggestions, those songs that you love, maybe, but other people don't.
Do you have an example?
Yes.
Yourself?
One song I thought of is MacArthur Park.
Okay.
Because I think it's a fantastic song, but other people think it's bad.
Okay.
It got listed, in Dave Barry did a book of bad songs, and it was like number one on his list.
Oh, wow. Huh.
We Built This City on Rock and Roll.
Oh, yeah, it's a terrible song.
See, I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I was right when I was in high school, and I just, it brings back weird memories for me.
Okay.
I don't, and it just seemed, I can see the video, I can see everything about that song that I don't,
yeah.
I didn't.
What love. Blows my mind about that song, so it's, is it Starship or Jefferson Starship?
Starship.
Just Starship. Mm-hmm. But It's still, there's still a through line back to
sure
Jefferson
is.
Airplane.
Sure is. And they're just doing a lot of just hand pumping,
like
you know.
Pumps,
we
yeah.
built this city. Yeah, we did. I don't know if this qualifies, but for some reason, the minute I open my eyes today, I'm singing Come On Eileen.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of people don't like that. It's real bouncy. I'm not happy I'm singing it still, but I don't dislike the song.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah. And it seems like a happy way to start a Monday morning, but I have no idea why. Do you ever wake up like singing something?
I do wake up sometimes. It's more in the middle of the night. I'll wake up with a song and like maybe I was dreaming something.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it was.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing to like, and I keep doing the like the really nice bouncy. It was pleasant, but I know myself, it's going to take me 2-3 days to get Come On Eileen out of my head. And I've probably planted it in your head right now. You're listening and you think.
You're okay. Welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to be hearing Come On Eileen for quite a while. I loved that when that came out. That song, I loved 99 Luftballons. Mm-hmm. For some reason, that sort of reminded me. And didn't realize what that was about.
Oh, yeah. No, that's kind of a serious topic.
Sure is.
Yeah.
Didn't feel like that at the time, but.
No.
So, okay, so we kind of get, what is it again?
Well, Chris is calling it Awesomely Bad Songs.
Awesomely Bad Songs.
Yeah.
Huh. This will be really interesting to see what people.
So text in 218-326-1234.
We love hearing from you, and we want to hear about our question of the week this week is about the seasonal changes and like what kind of things are you changing. Right now, are you starting to, I haven't put up a Christmas tree, but I'm starting to make some Christmas things.
Okay.
Not cookies. I talked to my cousin yesterday and she was already baking Christmas cookies. She's putting them in the freezer because she needs them for book club or something.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't quite done that, but I'm crafting some things and I have some Christmas-like things out with some blinky lights, but not full-on Christmas tree. I will wait till, Thanksgiving weekend, so I don't have too long to wait on that.
Yeah.
But it just kind of lightens up my house and it feels really good as there's less time where you're outside that you're doing more stuff inside and kind of, you know, cleaning out closets. How about you? When do you begin the rollout of the Christmas tree and all of that stuff?
Christmas tree, I tend to wait like maybe 2 to 3 weeks before Christmas.
Okay.
So not I give it at least a good week after Thanksgiving. And it depends when Thanksgiving is. This year it's kind of on the later side. So, yeah. And
Do you have a tradition of when you do put your Christmas tree up? Are you listening to like Charlie Brown Christmas?
Yes.
Album?
Yes, that's one of them. I have a Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra like together Christmas CD. Nice. Definitely put on the Christmas music, and that's kind of that too. I don't want to do too much.
Yeah,
because it gets really old by Christmas. So I'd like to just ease into it. But we'll do some Christmassy decorations after Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
like that weekend, or I'm gonna be gone, so I might be a little later. But right. Like things like, you know, the stockings, and then you start to get Christmas cards. So those I mm-hmm. like, you know, I display, and I have this buffet, and usually it's this, you know, one like lace kind of table runner thing on it. But at Christmas time, I have this one that's got like little teddy bears. This all came from my grandma because it was her buffet, and so this stuff came with it. So I switched to this Christmas table runner on that, and
yeah, all those things out there. I'm surprised by how much I think I've always kind of decorated, but in the last 5-6 years, like I really like it. It really mm-hmm. helps me get through the winter, and I go early and I stay long, and that surprises me. Allie from Chisholm is listening in today. I'm curious, Allie, if you are singing Come On Eileen, but she says for the song, what's the song, what we're gathering for Headwaters?
Awesomely Bad.
Awesomely Bad, Awesomely Bad. Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush is her recommendation. She said it is not a bad song, but some unenlightened people cannot handle it.
Right. I like that.
Thanks, Allie. Good to hear from you this morning.
All right, now let's take a listen to our album of the week. We get to kick it off here on Monday morning. It's called All Hat by Joshua Headley. As a country musician, Headley has dabbled in varying kinds of country over the years. This is his love letter to Western swing, also known as country jazz. And Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel produced this album. He is a legend himself in the Western swing world. And this features a co-write with Brennan Lee, a musician. And this record is meant to be heard and experienced live in a dance hall. At its core, Western swing is just dance music. Bob Wills didn't play theaters. He played dance halls, according to Joshua Headley. So we'll be hearing lots more of it throughout the week, and you can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear from Joshua Headley is called Over the Line.
I took a little gamble with love. I thought we'd make a pretty good pair. But with one roll of the dice, I'm paying the price. And I know it don't seem fair. She wanted a big full house, but I was thinking two of a kind. You got to give the girl a hand. She took a good man and left him busted flat and over the line. We built our little house of cards. I thought I made a pretty safe bet. But since you've been gone, I'm out on my own, and I ain't hit a jackpot yet. So if you feel like playing the field, well, here's a little word of advice. Keep it close to the vest, or you'll be just like the rest, busted flat and over the line. Thank you. house of cards. I thought I made a pretty safe bet. But since you've been gone, I'm out on my own, and I ain't hit a jackpot yet. So if you feel like playing the field, well, here's a little word of advice. Keep it close to the vest, or you'll be just like the rest, busted flat and over the line. Busted flat and over the line.
From our album of the week, that's Joshua Headley. The album's called All Hat. That one is called Over the Line.
You can definitely hear the influence of the
Ray Benson. From Asleep at the Wheel.
Yeah, for sure. I always think of Ray Benson with little Amanda Shires. That's where she got her start touring when she was like a teenager with Asleep at the Wheel as their violinist or fiddler. Okay. Yeah. Cool stuff. That's our album of the week. We always want to know what you think. You can find more information at kexe.org or text us 218-326-1234. We did get another text that came in. Susan from Cotton, good to hear from you this morning. She said, I almost always have what I call earworms, songs that ring in my head. Happily, I have no idea what this Eileen song is, so it's not resonating for me. You know, if I played it right now, Susan, you would know. I know you would. But I would nominate Breakfast at Tiffany's. It has a really kind of cool chorus, but man, it gets stuck in my head for days and drives me nuts.
You know that song?
Uh-huh.
Deep Blue Something?
Uh-huh. It does get stuck in your head. I'm trying not to let it get in my head is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Earworms, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the strangest things that become the earworm. It's not what you want it to be.
A couple weeks ago, I did a little record shopping and I got a Kenny Rogers and the first edition album. And well, it has, you know, What Condition My Condition Is, which I love. But the song that's been sticking in my head is called Something's Burning. And it's got this drum beat. And that just like that drum beat keeps like popping up in my head.
Boy, do you see my eyes going weird there? I was thinking of all these different, I mean, not, you know, just solo Kenny Rogers. That's been an earworm for me before. That was such a big deal.
Yeah.
My mom loved Kenny Rogers, so we heard it all the time. But then the one always that led me to Glenn Campbell for some reason in Wichita Lineman, and that one very easily gets stuck in my head, so... Earworms, I don't know if we want to know from you on that because it's going to get more things stuck in our head. But you can text us 218-326-1234. I'm curious, Susan, if the Breakfast at Tiffany's, if you ever like wake up and it's playing in your head. The worm is there.
Yeah. that would be a good way to, like, it's breakfast, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a breakfast song.
There you go. Is it time for best wishes?
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
We do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary. I'll start with yesterday, November 16th, Greg Davis. Happy 51st to you from Brainerd and Mary Kay Gallagher from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Happy birthday, Mary.
And today is November 17th. Happy 52nd anniversary to Anna and Bob Johnson. They split their time between Florida and Grand Rapids. Rick McDonald, happy 68th to you in Grand Rapids. Sarah Rash turning 25 today. Laura Prickett, happy 63rd to you. And Bruce Meyer from New Prague is celebrating a birthday as well. Our best wishes to you all. If you have birthday or anniversary greetings to share, you can always text us 218-326-1234. We've got some new music from Minnesota artist Paul Spring. He's got a forthcoming album out called Dumb and Free, and this song's called Never Get Me Down.
gets me low, never gets me low. Whatever gets me low, never gets me down. Death says he wants to go on all around. Sorrow thinks he can drop me to the ground. But black and blue are friends. Sound the bell again. Whatever gets me though, never gets me though. Whatever gets me though, never gets me
new music from Minnesota artist Paul Spring, Never Get Me Down. His latest release is called Dumb and Free.
His music can feel very cinematic.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of, you feel like you're there. You could see a scene of maybe someone slowly running through a field or something. I don't know. There's something about it that is sort of visual because it's really layered. Maybe that is that the way to say it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Talking about music can be kind of... hard because it feels emotional. We heard from our friend Laura, who was listening in about earworms, and she said, I wake up with songs in my head all the time. I also can't connect them with a dream or anything. I guess I should keep track and see if the songs have a common theme or something. Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah. Text us with your awesomely bad song suggestions for Headwaters today, 218-326-1234. Support comes from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public, watermarkartcenter.org.
And we receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you, more at moveitrealestate.com.
And we thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org.
Coming up will be what we're reading. You can take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library. It's from 5 to 6 Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library.
It is time for our daily dose of phenology. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate, John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date.
On today's date, November 17th, 1987, red-winged blackbirds, a flock of them, about a dozen birds, are still hanging around Prairie Lake. And I'm not sure quite why, but they are managing somehow to find enough food to keep themselves alive and active. I suspect that they will be heading south anytime soon. There are seldom any records of red-winged blackbirds in northern Minnesota over the winter. Perhaps one or two, but never more than that. And they typically return with the robins about the mid to late March, when the temperature starts climbing back above 37 degrees for an average each day. That's when we would expect to see the red-winged blackbirds back in our area. Why this group has stayed so long, I don't know. They aren't confiding in me, but nonetheless, here they are, and it certainly set a record for a late observation of red-winged blackbirds.
That is our daily phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning, 7:20, for John's latest observations. We'll also have some student reports starting at around 6:45. It's the Monday Morning Show here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Heidi Holton. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. What we're reading is our show all about books, produced by our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, a conversation with Minnesota novelist Will Weaver. His new book is Black Dirt, Bright Stars. It's book two in his Haugen family saga. That's the family we met in his previous book, Power and Light.
Minnesota writer Will Weaver is back with his second novel in the Haugen family saga. Black Dirt, Bright Stars follows his 2023 novel, Power and Light, where we first meet the Haugen family, four siblings of Norwegian immigrants who are struggling to make a living off their farm in northeast North Dakota. Black Dirt, Bright Stars picks up after the family lose a court battle against an evil and powerful man, and as the story moves forward, justice is never far from their minds. Spanning from the 1930s to the 1980s, Black Dirt, Bright Stars is told mainly through Jenny Haugen's point of view as she steps up and leads the family forward. Will Weaver says of his character, "She is easy to underestimate, but that is at your peril." Here's our What We're Reading conversation with Will Weaver. Black Dirt, Bright Stars is your new novel. It can be read as a standalone, but of course, the experience will be enriched by reading the first book, Power and Light. So I wonder if you could just reintroduce us to the Haugen family who we met in Power and Light.
Well, thank you. I'm still interested in the Scandinavian experience in the upper Midwest. That's my background, the Norwegian side of my family. And I'm drawing heavily on that immigrant experience of my grandfather as a small boy. Some of those stories became Power and Light. Settling into North Dakota and then northwestern Minnesota. Like most immigrants, struggling with language, culture, agency. And a novel needs a plot, and the plot was strongly taken from an incident, a crime against one of my great aunts for which there was never any justice. And I remembered that as a small boy, that something had happened to her, my great aunt. And so her story in the fight for justice became the plot of my fictional family, the Haugens in Power and Light.
So one of the most memorable characters, at least to me, in Power and Light was Jenny, the youngest of the Haugens. And we get more of her here in the new book, Black Dirt, Bright Stars. And she is just a force to be reckoned with. Of all the Haugens, why did this story focus mostly on Jenny?
Yes, the Haugens consist of four siblings. In Power and Light, there are three sisters and the older brother. Now, two of those siblings were born in Norway and two in America. And that's no small matter. The oldest brother still clings to Norway. The youngest, Jenny, is a more modern young woman. And it's she who steps up and leads the family forward. And I really enjoyed writing her, creating her, making her three-dimensional. She is easy to underestimate, but that is at your peril.
And she proves that time and time again throughout the story, which is just a wonderful aspect of her character. I'd also like to talk about Sally, and she is the Haugen sibling who is struggling with the trauma of the sexual assault against her by the town doctor. And then she's got the added trauma of her child being taken away from her too. And what really struck me in the beginning of this book is how the moments where the family all kind of silently understands that, boy, she really needs help, but they're kind of at a loss of at what to do. I wonder if you can talk about, like, what is the dynamic there? Is it more of a sign of the times? Is it a Scandinavian kind of culture thing where we see this person struggling, but, you know, what do we do at this point?
Well, I think you're onto it. It is both a sign of the times, and the times here are in the late 30s and early 1940s, and then onward for Sally. Again, the assault is kind of a life sentence for her, as it would be for any person. And it also is an aspect of the Norwegian culture, the matter of silences and secrets. But again, back to the times, where was the support then? Where were the call-in numbers? Where were the counselors? Well, none of that was available for women going through assaults. And so they, the Haugens, have to deal with this on their own, in their own way. And as Jenny said in the first page of the novel, this is not over, not while I'm alive. And then that is the engine that drives Black Dirt, Bright Stars.
In Power and Light, it was very clear that the family had each other, but they were very isolated from other people in their town. And in Black Dirt, Bright Stars, we see their family grow from both within, and then and additionally, like a found family kind of forms too. Can you talk about how the Haugens evolve as a family in this book?
Family is the heart of both of these novels. And I'm very interested in the, what we'll call the arc of family, how families grow and thrive or become stuck in neutral or in some cases peter out. And that is of great interest to me. And I think in literature, people, and I'm sort of banking on this, people love a family novel. They love to see those stories of how families evolve. And I wanted to show in particular this immigrant family gaining agency in America. And agency is land for them. And agency is power, and land is power. But to see the family grow and come into modern times was a really fun thing for me to create.
So with that added family dynamic working, the addition of sons and daughters and cousins and adopted children, it made me wonder how much you were drawing from your own family dynamic.
Yes, the growth of family is kind of a miraculous thing. Marriages, or I was just reading in middle March a little bit, and there's a wonderful line, imprudent marriage and imprudent marriages. Some marriages don't work out well. Some are quite prudent and are very, very successful. But yes, I'm drawing on my own family and its expansion outward geographically to a family in Atlanta, on the West Coast, here and there, and back to Norway. That's kind of a miraculous thing, how families spread outward. So yes, I've always drawn on my family experiences in my fiction to at least some degree.
This is What We're Reading on KAXE KBXE. We're talking with Minnesota writer Will Weaver. Book 2 of the Haugen Saga has just come out. It's called Black Dirt, Bright Stars. I always think it's interesting in series writing to be out touring for your book while also working on the next book in the series. And I wonder if you can share what the response was like for Power and Light. And did any of that help inform where you took the story in Black Dirt, Bright Stars?
That's a really, really good question. I will tell you that I had the grand plan to have a big, fat, 1,000-page doorstop of a novel that did everything. But my editor said, as I got toward what I thought was the end of Power and Light, he said, I don't think it's the end, and it's going to get too big and too long. And so we made a decision at that point to do the sequel. But back to being on the road, on the book tour trail, doing readings, it is instructive to hear people's reactions. And one of them was the matter of using the Norwegian language in Power and Light, because I start out actually in Norway at the end of the 20th century. The Haugen family is just leaving Norway, and there's a lot of Norwegian language. And I used my skills, I hope, to sort of translate that on the fly, but still it put a lot of pressure on the reader. So there was that factor. There was also the matter of the sexual assault and me crossing gender lines to write that. Mm. And so we had that discussion often, and it was very, very useful, very helpful for me to hear that. And I think for the audience to understand that I'm certainly not writing about Sally's victimization as a plot gambit. Okay. It's a family story, and that is, I think, gender aside, that gives me the authority to write that. So those discussions were useful.
So you and I had a chance to talk when Power and Light was published, and you had said that writing it, and you kind of alluded to that earlier in this interview here, writing it was a way to help you unpack that rather dark part of your family's history and their experiences as immigrants in North Dakota, that lacking of agency, the injustices against your family. Is this still the case in this new book? Did you feel that you were still unpacking those things, or does Black Dirt, Bright Stars represent something more than that?
I think there was a great catharsis for me finishing Black Dirt, Bright Stars. I said when we had our conversation that it's impossible to apply justice retroactively, but at least it can be addressed and it can be honored. People's lives can be honored in retrospect. And I feel like I've done that and done justice to my old family, as I call them, my great aunt in particular, and saluted our Midwest along the way. You know, this novel, Black Dirt, Bright Stars, covers essentially 40 years from the 1940s into 1980. And it was fun as a kind of a side benefit to see the 20th century unfold, the heart of the 20th century unfold.